Austin Mills has just got out of surgery a moment ago. I think things look good for her under the circumstances.
An Anchorage police officer recovers from a shooting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 9th of June. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, the Kotzebue Borough Assembly votes to close the city library.
Opening a liquor store and closing the library, I can tell you one thing, the kids don't want that. They don't want either of those things.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska State Elks Association, hosting veterans from Fort Richardson and Fort Wainwright to the Wounded Warriors Kenai River King Fishing Event. Information at alaskastateelks.com. And by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
An Anchorage police officer was shot early this morning while making a traffic stop on the city's east side. It's the second attempted killing of an APD officer this year. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Normally, Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan's weekly Wednesday afternoon press conferences have a number of topics. Not today. There was only one item, the shooting of Officer Gene Mills, here described by Police Chief Mark Mew.
About 3:15 this morning, Officer Mills observed a car that was suspicious in her mind and committed a traffic infraction. She's subsequently stopped that vehicle at the vicinity of DeBar and Beaver. Sometime during the exchange with the driver, we're still working on the details of that, the driver produced a gun and fired multiple shots. She was struck.
Mills is a 12-year veteran of APD and has spent much of her duty as a patrol officer on the mid-shift from 11 p.m. to 9 a.m. According to Chief Mew, assistants rushed to Mills in about 1 minute. She was taken to a local hospital where she underwent surgery.
Officer Mills has just got out of surgery a moment ago. I think things look good for her under the circumstances, but the surgery went well and she will recover.
An accompanying press release says her recovery time is expected to be significant. The chief released few details from the investigation that has seen dozens of officers, detectives, and SWAT team members working the case throughout the day. The shooter's car was a maroon four-door Ford Taurus. Police report it was found about 7 a.m. abandoned in a parking lot near Northern Lights Boulevard and Burgaw Street. The car has been taken to the police station where it's being examined for evidence and leads. Police have made no arrests. Mew says they will utilize the press to notify the public should they begin to openly seek a suspect. This is the second officer shooting in Anchorage this year. On January 9th, APD officer Jason Allen was the victim of a drive-by shooting in a case that remains unsolved. He survived multiple wounds but is still recovering. Mills, like Allen, was wearing a protective vest. Some reporters asked Sullivan about his mayoral campaign promise to reduce violent crime in the city. Besides these two officer attacks, they pointed to last month's shooting of a man at a weekend picnic in a city park. Sullivan responded.
What I campaigned on was the fact that between 2003 and 2008, there was a growing rate of crime, particularly in violent crime. That's one of the reasons I ran for office. That's a trend that you don't turn around overnight.
Chief Mew was asked if he thought, given the shootings, if Anchorage was a safe city.
For a city of its size and composition, I think Anchorage is a reasonably safe city. Do bad things happen in Anchorage? Yep, they sure do. Most people who go about their normal affairs, you know, aren't victimized. Most people. Does that mean we don't have our challenges? No, that doesn't mean that at all. Some days we win, some days it's more difficult.
The chief said, along with its own officers, the police department has received assistance from the U.S. Marshals Task Force, the FBI, the University Police, and has offers of help from the state troopers. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
The Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly in Kotzebue voted yesterday to discontinue $125,000 in funds for the public library that will force it to close, leaving the region with no access to a public library. The library is part of a consortium with the University of Alaska Chukchi campus. The college portion will remain open, but the public side will close unless the Borough Assembly reconsiders. Calls to Borough Mayor Martha Whiting and Borough Assembly members were not returned by airtime. But Stacy Glazier, who was the library's director for 15 years before leaving the position last year, says past attempts to close the library have always brought an outcry from the community.
Whenever there's a threat to the library budget, people mobilize. People get very upset. Lots of people went to the previous assembly meetings to testify about the importance of the library to them. Some people wrote some letters. Some people called in. They took all the testimony and still decided that they were going to cut the library funding.
Chukchi campus faculty members Susan Andrews and her husband John Creed both say it's a terrible loss.
Reading is the basis of all success educationally and professionally, and also great readers make better citizens. We should not allow this kind of short-sighted decision-making to prevail. We may never know what future academic successes will be impeded or malnourished because we have failed to create a place in Kotzebue and in the surrounding villages that respects quiet and where people can go to read and think and grow intellectually.
The couple both teach writing, literature, and humanities courses at the Chukchi campus. Susan Andrews says there is little else in the way of structured, safe activities for children in the region.
So few things for children to do in the community, and you know, we already see a lot of kids who are adrift, and for the borough to turn their backs on these kids, I think it's just a terrible abdication of responsibility of the adults and the elected leaders to support the youth.
Local author and wildlife photographer Seth Kantner says the borough's actions don't square with the dialogue about supporting youth.
There's endless rhetoric in this region about education and the kids this and the kids that. Lots of talk about our kids' future, and then they turn around and close the library. So the kids use the hell out of that place. It's right across from the school, and kids pour across the street when school lets out. And new people to town use the library, and unemployed artists and ivory carvers and kids, and I don't know, and the smartest people use the library. So leaves kind of a hole in the community.
Kantner says this isn't the first time the library has been closed.
When they got rid of the bars in Kotzebue, they immediately closed the library. And this time, Kotzebue's all set to open a liquor store and close the library. Maybe they can do it in the same week. So it's a real turnaround. And opening a liquor store and closing the library, I can tell you one thing, the kids don't want that.
Kantner is married to Stacy Glazier. Their daughter, China, is 11. She says without the library, there's not much to do.
I go there pretty much every day, and that's the only place for books in town. There's no bookstore or anything. And books are expensive to get here, and it would be really nice to have it.
Her good friend, Lorena Gebhardt, says she takes her 2-year-old brother.
Loves it there already. Then I take him there to my help me pick out my books to read.
It's not clear when the facility will close. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaskan author looks at the conflicted relationship humans have with the Earth.
I would say it's very rare to find somebody who doesn't feel a real connection to nature and to wildlife and a real desire to see it survive on this planet.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Four candidates running to be Alaska's next lieutenant governor squared off in a Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce-sponsored forum yesterday. The candidates, Republicans Jay Ramris, Mead Treadwell, and Eddie Burke, and Democrat Diane Benson, took questions on a range of topics, including two initiatives that will be on the August 24th primary ballot. Proposition 1 would basically forbid public employees and officials from lobbying. Eddie Burke of Anchorage says he supports the measure, which would also limit political action of entities, including unions, involved in government contracting.
Let's get the union control out of our government, okay? It's costing you more money. It's costing you businesses more money. It should be a fair, competitive process.
Fellow Republican and Fairbanks State Representative Jay Ramris disagreed, saying he's against the so-called anti-corruption proposition. Ramris called the technical multi-paragraph ballot measure bad public policy.
It's obtuse. It will slow commerce. It will slow the ability of entities like this chamber, like your businesses, to speak on behalf of this community.
Another Republican, Mead Treadwell of Anchorage, is also opposed to Prop 1. Treadwell says as lieutenant governor, he would help craft ballot proposition language to avoid problems he sees with the anti-corruption proposition.
I believe it's unconstitutional. I've talked to the attorney general, and there are very many questions that will be issued in the courts if that initiative passes. And one of the problems with the way our initiatives work is that we need to have the lieutenant governor work on the drafting of these initiatives so that you have constitutional measures put before the voters.
Democratic candidate Diane Benson sided with Ramris and Treadwell in opposing Proposition 1, saying that while everyone supports the premise of the measure, she has concerns about unintended effects.
I think that we need a clean election process, most definitely. Anti-corruption is something that we all, I believe, want to see occur, but we got to think about it very carefully how we do that so that we're not limiting the process for those who have lesser means.
Benson of Anchorage was the only candidate who voiced opposition to requiring parental consent for abortion for women under 18, the subject of the other proposition that will be on the August ballot. Four other candidates running for a lieutenant governor, three Democrats, a Republican, and a Libertarian, did not participate in yesterday's Fairbanks Chamber Forum. The candidates are vying to replace current Lieutenant Governor Craig Campbell, who is not running. Nearly 600 firefighters are hustling to take advantage of a break in the weather to get control of a complex of wildfires in the Delta Junction area. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports from Delta, they're working in anticipation of the return of dry conditions.
Cool, rainy weather over the past 4 days has slowed the fires, which include the 19,400-acre Gills Fire, burning near the Pogo Gold Mine, about 25 miles northwest of Delta. Tom Lavanino, a spokesman for the interagency organization that's heading up the fire suppression effort, says the Gills Fire is now about 50% contained. He says the wildfire, for now, no longer threatens the power line that leads to the mine, and that electricity to the mine was restored Monday, although lightning strikes in the area on Tuesday again briefly interrupted power. Lavanino says the rain has made roads muddy and sometimes has grounded aircraft, but overall it's helped firefighters get the upper hand.
The last couple of days the crews have been directly approaching the fire and making the black line right next to the fire edge itself.
Lavanino says the next 2 days will be crucial for the firefighters because the agency's meteorologist predicts hot, dry weather will return to the interior by week's end. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
A village on the lower Yukon will head to the polls this summer to decide their alcohol future. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
Mountain Village is the latest Alaskan community considering less restrictive laws on alcohol importation. After a successful petition drive, the village could become damp with an alcohol distribution site. Alan Queenie of Mountain Village was the lead sponsor of the petition.
I don't see any way that it's going to make it better, but it's going to give people more responsibility. You know, if it passes, I hope the people could really control it.
The dam status being considered would allow the city to distribute imported alcohol from a single facility, but the sale of alcohol from within the community would be prohibited. Mountain Village has been a dry community since 1984, according to the Alcoholic Beverage Control Board. But alcohol abuse continues, and Queenie says because it's banned, there's a major incentive to bring it in illegally. A bottle of cheap liquor sells for $120 to $150 there.
You know, there's so much bootlegging and homebrew selling. I think it's going to work out if it's legalized.
But Queenie says not everyone in Mountain Village thinks the same way.
It's very strong opinions from both sides, so there's a lot of people for it, against it.
Many say that banning the possession of alcohol reduces the overall health and safety impact on a community. If the city does loosen restrictions, it would create an essentially damp geographic area. The neighboring villages of St. Mary's and Pitkiss Point are currently the only damp communities in the lower Yukon area. The special election has been scheduled for July the 27th. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Chickaloon tribe plans a demonstration tomorrow against coal exploration in the tribe's traditional use area. Angela Wade is the environmental program director for the Chickaloon tribe. She says Usabelli Coal is in the initial stages of building an access road to coal deposits in the vicinity.
It's almost directly adjacent off of the Glen Highway to our tribal school. It's in the vicinity of many tribal citizens' housing. It's very close to our restoration project, and actually where they're starting the other part of the road is near our low-income housing.
Usabelli Coal plans to access coal in the Wishbone Hill coal lease area near Palmer. Wade says the road to the coal will adversely impact Moose Creek, a culturally significant traditional fishing site. The Chickaloon Village Traditional Council has spent many years and more than $1 million to restore salmon habitat and salmon runs in Moose Creek.
It has the potential to devastate the restoration work that we've done.
Wade says blasting and hauling coal near Moose Creek will bisect a sacred hunting area, which tribal members use for hunting ceremonial potlatch moose. She says the area's moose population is certain to be impacted by the blasting and other proposed mining activities. According to Wade, the coal access road will have up to 200 trucks per day carrying loads of coal, spewing coal dust over the Chickaloon tribe's traditional hunting and gathering area.
It's time for us to get involved. And really, you know, this decision doesn't come lightly for the tribe to get involved, but this area especially is sacred to us. You know, we have the cultural and religious rites in this area. We do potlatch moose. We've done all this restoration work. It's this reciprocal relationship with the fish and wildlife that live in this area, and we feel very strongly and very connected. Historically, this was a fish camp for us. It's so close, and it affects us disproportionately.
Usabelli has petitioned the Matanuska-Susitna Borough for a right-of-way permit to access the coal. Borough approval of that plan is pending. Usabelli spokeswoman Lorelei Carter says the company is building an exploration trail to the Wishbone Hill site under existing permits.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Petersburg voters will decide this fall whether to ban smoking in most workplaces and public spaces. In a 5-2 vote Monday, the City Council gave its final approval for a citywide smoking ordinance to go on the ballot. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein reports.
Supporters have said the measure is mainly aimed at protecting workers from secondhand smoke. It would ban smoking in bars, shops, private clubs, offices, virtually all businesses where there are employees, whether or not they're open to the public. It would also prohibit outdoor smoking within 5 feet of public doorways, sporting events, playgrounds, and ball fields. When a more generic version of the measure was originally introduced this spring, a handful of residents spoke out against it. Since then, the council has made several changes recommended by a committee of smokers, non-smokers, bar owners, and other concerned residents. For instance, bars would be allowed to have enclosed and well-ventilated rooms where smokers could still light up, but employees don't have to go. The outdoor rules are a little less strict. Also, the restrictions would not apply to fishing boats or other mobile marine vessels. But they would still apply to land vehicles, cars, or trucks, and that's been an ongoing concern for Councillor Mark Jensen. Jensen is one of two councillors who have been more critical of the ordinance in general.
I read that in vehicles. If, for instance, I have a business, and if my vehicle's used for business, then if I had a friend that smoked cigarettes, he couldn't smoke in my vehicle. And not that people do anyway, but just I know I have friends that are in that situation.
Jensen proposed an amendment to exempt vehicles from the prohibitions on smoking in enclosed workplaces. The way Jensen interpreted the wording, a skipper or his crew could not smoke in a truck with the name of their vessel on the side. Ordinance Review Committee Chair Ben Johnson agreed the current wording seemed to prevent anyone from smoking in a work vehicle, but he explained the committee's intent was only to protect employees.
If someone was a saner and had their boat name on the side of their truck and no one else drove around with them, I thought, kind of covered in where we talked about when someone could work, if they had an office where no one else ever went into, like an accountant, they could smoke in their office. It was the same idea where, in this case, if no other employees were in the truck and ever had to go in the truck, then smoking was fine. That was the intention.
The amendment to exempt land vehicles from the measure failed on a 5-2 vote. Only Jensen and Councillor Dan Hickman voted for the change. It was the third and final council reading for the smoking ordinance, and the agenda included a public hearing, but no one from the general public turned out to comment for or against the measure this time around. The overall ordinance passed its third reading by a 5-2 vote, with Councillors Jensen and Hickman opposed. Hickman emphasized that the final decision will still be up to the voters.
And everybody in Petersburg will then have to decide as to whether they now are going to mandate this type of ordinance to the private citizen.
The smoking ordinance will appear on the Petersburg ballot this October. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
It's a story Alaskans know well. Natives lived here for centuries, respecting the environment. Then the Russians showed up with a very different philosophy and quickly wiped out Alaska resources. For Anchorage author Charles Woolforth, the familiar tale highlights the conflicted relationship humans have with the planet. He takes a look at that relationship in his new book, The Fate of Nature: Rediscovering Our Ability to Rescue the Earth. Woolforth says, researching the book, he discovered the best environmental decisions are made at the local level.
And I think that's almost an Alaska truism. The fishermen tried to get double-hull tankers in Prince William Sound before the pipeline was built. They were overruled by the federal government, by the courts. And if that Exxon Valdez had been a double-hull tanker, it would have turned out very differently. So a lot of times these things will bubble up from the bottom level. And this is where, you know, I'm not a Tea Partier and I'm not a conservative, not from that point of view. But I think there is something to be said for going back to the concept of federalism, where local people get more power over their own communities. With power comes responsibility and a desire to care. And I don't think that these big national solutions often work very well.
The spill in the Gulf will have environmental ripple effects for decades. Even though the book was written before this blowout, you covered the Exxon Valdez. How do these things factor in?
To me, it points to the need to look at this more systematically. I'm not interested in politicians telling me we're going to get better blowout preventers, we're going to get more boom, we're going to do a better job next time. We've already heard that before. What we need to start talking about is changing the system by which we relate to the environment, not saying we need new politicians in the same offices, but saying we need things like Regional Citizens Advisory Council in Prince William Sound, which has worked. The other thing you see is, just like in Prince William Sound, everybody all over the country uses the oil, but the people who pay the price for the disaster are those local people. Same thing in the Gulf of Mexico. We all use the oil and we all feel bad about the spill, but the ones who are really paying the price are those fishermen and those motel owners down on the shore of the Gulf of Mexico. And so they really ought to have the power to protect themselves beforehand.
What did you discover in the Native community as they became corporate owners. How or has it changed the tenets of environmental awareness and concern?
Well, I think that, you know, the whole story of the Alaska Native Claims Land Act is such a long and complex one. But a really deep part of it is this change into a corporate culture, which is really, I think most ANCSA CEOs would tell you, is really incompatible with Native culture and with Native lifeways. It's Oliver Levitt, who was the former chairman of Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, told me, we live in Nupiaq lifeway. Then when we get in the boardroom, we live the corporate competitive way, and that's how it has to work because that's the world they're in. When it comes to dealing with natural resources, I don't think that's served a lot of Native corporations really well. I look at the way timber was treated in Southeast Alaska during the big NOL sales as it was being liquidated, and I don't think that really reflected the philosophy of those cultures as those, you know, trees were liquidated. And you hear them defended, and I'm sure that's a controversial point of view, and people would be offended by it. What do I have to interpret their philosophies? But I've spent a lot of time in Native communities, and I've talked to elders, and I think I understand what the basic philosophy of that lifeway is. And I don't think it has to do with liquidating your resources and selling them overseas. So there is an incompatibility there, and it's obviously a huge struggle, and it's really one of the biggest stories of Alaska culture in the future, of how those are resolved.
And how about personally, Charles? What did you learn in this research and writing? Were you surprised to learn there's more concern than not, or disappointed to learn that there is less among people you interviewed?
I would say it's very rare to find somebody who doesn't feel a real connection to nature and to wildlife and a real desire to see it survive on this planet. And that is ultimately what gives me hope. We all discount that. We all discount our positive feelings and our positive desire to do good for the world and think of, well, that's not the real world or that's not real human nature. But, you know, if we all feel that way, then there's something real there. And I really think it's a matter of changing our systems and our relationships and our society to where some of more of our positive wishes really are carried through. I think it's as simple as that. And in that way, it comes down to every single individual and how we relate to each other, how we build communities, and how our communities relate to nature.
Charles Woolforth's new book is called The Fate of Nature. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Ellis in Delta, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg. Len Anderson also reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.